Sometimes these people come along in any field, whether it's science or medicine or the arts, who just revolutionize things.
It is hard to overstate the incredible reach of Louis Armstrong. He defined American culture, and he did it with the force of his talent as a musician, singer, composer, author, innovator, entertainer, actor, and bandleader. Louis transcended racial barriers, and he became America's ambassador to the world.
That's the way nature and God designed Louis Armstrong. He's modern forever and ever and ever, and we'll never catch up to him.
Louis Armstrong was magnetic.
Al Capone loved Louis Armstrong like a brother.
Louis Armstrong captured the essence of human relations in what he did, the feeling, the mood, the spirit, and the hope of mankind.
Armstrong's legacy is best captured in his music.
For as long as there are ears to hear, his music will be played and enjoyed and studied, and he will endure.
He even unseated the Beatles from the top of the charts. There was only one Louis Armstrong.
The only one of his kind, a titanic figure of his and our time. Veritable Picasso, a Stravinsky, a Casals, a Louis Armstrong.
First trip was to London in 1932. When I met Purcell Brooks at the docks, he said, "Hello, Satchmo." Well, they'd been calling me Satchel Mouth in New Orleans. So when he shook my hand, he said, "Hello, Satchmo." I asked the trombone player, "Why did he call me Satchmo? My name's Satchel Mouth." And this cat looked at me and said, "That's because you got mo mouth." Yeah, I'm stuck with it.
By the time he had reached his early 30s, Louis Armstrong had made his mark. He had digested the sounds of his hometown of New Orleans and brought them up the river to Chicago, where he joined his mentor, Joe King Oliver. He went on to New York City to join the first great big band led by Fletcher Henderson, then returned to Chicago, billed as the world's greatest trumpet player, only to turn the world upside down with his hot fives and hot sevens. Louis made jazz swing, took the trumpet to heights never before imagined, and made the jazz solo an art form unto itself. And what a soloist Louis was. And so it was that by 1932, Louis Armstrong had established himself as the preeminent voice in jazz. But there were also problems, big problems. Gangsters ruled the nightclub scene in Chicago and competed fiercely with one another. The gangsters also controlled many musicians. Louis, who was always casual when it came to the business of music, allowed himself to be signed by two competing managers. It wasn't received lightly. He was told to get out of Chicago.
Somebody walked over to Armstrong and said, there's a telephone for you. And the guy took out a gun and marched him over to the phone. The guy said, "Are you going to be on that train tomorrow morning?" And he said, "Yes." And an act of courage and self-possession, he wasn't. He skipped town that night, and he was on the run for the next 2 years.
Rumor has it that gangsters ran Louis out of the country. While these rumors may be exaggerated, what we do know is that not too long after leaving Chicago, Louis found himself in Europe, residing in Paris. It proved to be the longest period he'd ever be away from the United States.
"Look out, boy! That tiger's coming there! He's gonna bite you! Ah!
I'm Nancy Wilson. inviting you to join Stanley Crouch for this special edition of NPR's Jazz Profiles. Satchmo, the wonderful world of Louis Armstrong. This hour, the conclusion of Louis Armstrong, the man and his music.
After an extended time away, in early 1935, Louis Armstrong returned to America and settled in Chicago. It was not a welcoming reception. In his personal life, his second wife, Lil, immediately hit him with an alimony suit. In his professional life, there were lip problems. Not always attentive to details, Louis was conned into signing conflicting contracts, and gangsters were fighting over him. Tommy Rockwell and Johnny Collins still both claimed that they represented him. Faced with these and other problems, Louis reconnected with Joe Glazer in May 1935. Dan Morgenstern is the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
Louis first met Glazer in 1927 when he was working at the Sunset Cafe in Chicago, where Joe was the manager. Glazer was connected with Al Capone. Only someone with the right kind of connections could have straightened out a dispute among gangsters. Glazer immediately settled with Collins and Rockwell, and while he was at it, he settled with Lil, too.
The way was now clear for Louis to pursue his career. On a handshake, Glazer would remain Louis Armstrong's manager throughout the remainder of his life. Veteran Armstrong trombonist, Trummy Young.
Well, I don't think Joe Glazer cared as much about his own mother as he did Louis, if you really want to know the truth.
Sometimes generous, other times difficult, Joe Glazer can best be described as an enigma.
If you wanted to negotiate mainstream American life, you needed the sponsorship of a white person who was going to look out for you and your economic interests.
Lawrence Bergreen is the author of Louis Armstrong, An Extravagant Life.
And that's exactly what Glazer was for Louis Armstrong and dozens of other African-American jazz musicians.
Joe Glazer, it was one of the finest bosses I ever ran into. There never was a boss man ever think about the help like he did. Still and all, he'd go raging mad if something went wrong, see?
He was the person who made sure they got paid when they were on the road, which they generally were, that they had a place to sleep at night, that they weren't turned away by hotels and restaurants and were generally treated like human beings and not second-class citizens. Joe Glazer became that white man.
Writer Nat Hentoff reflects on Joe Glazer.
Joe Glazer was blunt is a euphemism. He swore. He had, it seemed to me, pervasive contempt for about everyone except his dogs. But as a person, considering how gentle and humorous and essentially easygoing as Louis was, it's amazing that they got along for so many years.
I say, this is my man. I say, you tend the business, Daddy Glazer, and I blow the horn, and that's the way it is. It's been over 20-some years. We ain't even signed a contract. You understand?
The Glazer effect started to take hold, and for Louis Armstrong in 1936, things started to move. Glazer arranged for appearances on radio, which was the medium of the day.
When I was just a cub on Broadway, there was a man playing a cornet and singing in one of the Harlem hotspots. This man attracted the attention of the entire city in less than a week. As a matter of fact, he became a cult with a lot of people, and he still is. Here he is, the inventor of practically all the things nobody knew could be done with a horn. He sings and he tootles his own grand interpretation of On the Sunny Side of the Street. Mr. and Mrs. America, Louis Armstrong, open it up, hot man.
Grab your gold, grab your hat, baby. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet on the sunny side.
Armstrong biographer Dan Morgenstern.
He was on radio where he broke the collar barrier when he became the first black performer to have a sponsored radio show, a regular radio show, and that was the Fleischmann's Yeast Show, a weekly show, which was hosted by the famous crooner and sometime actor Rudy Vallee, who was a great Armstrong fan, and who saw to that Louis and his band were the summer replacement.
The radio show was a great springboard for Louis. It helped him reach white audiences, and it opened doors in downtown theaters in many cities throughout the U.S. where no black orchestra had ever appeared. Radio led Louis into the movies. Dan Morgenstern.
He was one of the first black artists to really have exposure in feature films. Bing Crosby got him involved in Pennies from Heaven, which Crosby himself produced. And he not only played in that, but also had a fairly substantial acting role.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven.
Armstrong's friend and confidant. Jack Bradley.
Louis was a great actor and entertainer. People forget Louis came from the vaudeville era, and entertaining was a great part of his music. So he was a natural for Hollywood. In his early passports, when he filled out occupation, he had put actor-musician.
I'm Stanley Crouch with the conclusion of Satchmo. Louis Armstrong, the man and his music, on this special edition of NPR's Jazz Profiles. With Joe Glazer at his side, 1936 was a great year for Louis, with the movie, an autobiography, a new recording contract, and an immediate hit record. Phil Schaap is a New York record producer and disc jockey.
It's in a confluence of activities for Armstrong. His Swing That Music book, his song, and the record Swing That Music. It's the line that he crosses in 36 and never falls back behind again, the line of stardom. In a modern superstardom sense, Louis Armstrong is a Hollywood star, as well as a jazz genius, as well as a great entertainer, one you're likely to encounter and enjoy.
I'm so happy as can be when this way the music blows.
Glazer signed Louis to a recording deal with a new label, Decca Records.
Those records, I think, will always bring happiness to me.
Now you blow through here, the music go down the round, oh, the whole, and it comes up here.
The goal at Decca was to make commercial records, and Louis disappointed no one. He enjoyed immediate success. Though jazz purists were offended, in 1937, Louis recorded with the commercially successful Mills Brothers. Singer Harry Mills remembers that in the studio, Louis had the magic touch.
It was such a wonderful feeling to say, we're going to make a record with the great Louis Armstrong, and I have all of those records under lock and key. Thank you. I believe these things will never be away from me as long as I'm alive, because I cherish them more than any other record that I have ever made with anybody else in this business. Flatfoot Flugee was a big song that we had together.
Boys, how about a little Flatfoot Flugee?
Oh, with the Floyd Floyd?
Yes, Floyd Floyd.
Oh, with the Floyd Floyd?
Oh, well, a one, a two.
A Flatfoot Flugee with the Floyd Floyd. A Flatfoot Flugee with the Floyd Floyd. A Flatfoot Flugee with the Floyd Floyd. Floyd Floyd, Floyd Floyd, Floyd Floyd.
Author Dan Morgenstern.
The Decca recordings include some of the things that were most cherished by trumpet players, but When you talk to trumpet players, Bobby Hackett and Maynard Ferguson, you couldn't think of two more different stylists. Both picked Strutting with Some Barbecue, the 1938 Decca recording, as their favorite all-time Louie.
Louis made his first appearance at Carnegie Hall in 1938 with the Paul Whiteman Band, and he appeared in Going Places, the film with Ronald Reagan, in which Louis plays a stable hand who sings to his horse, trumpeter Ruby Braff.
Everything he did, he shined in, but he was never given a chance to really have a real part where he wasn't the shoeshine boy or taking care of the stable horses, you know what I mean?
Hey, Uncle Tom, in case you don't know it, your horse was running away.
Yes, sir. I knows it.
Then you better stop jamming and get after him.
Just what I'm going to do, mister. The third thing that can stop that horse is this here trumpet.
You mean he's afraid of the trumpet?
Oh, no, sir. But he sure likes this song. I wrote it for him.
You wrote it for him?
Yes, sir. And I calls it by his name, Jeepers Creepers.
Jeepers Creepers.
Oh, Jeepers Creepers, where'd you get those beavers? Jeepers Creepers, where'd you get those eyes?
It was astounding. Just 3 years back from Europe, with his lip split and his career up in the air, the strength of Louis Armstrong's performance earned the song Jeepers Creepers an Oscar. In movies and through fronting big bands, Louis Armstrong really began to come into his own as a singer. From 1938, George Gershwin's Love Walked In.
Love walked right in and drove the shadows away. Love walked right in and brought my sunniest day.
From the movie, Every Day is a Holiday, Hoagy Carmichael's Jubilee.
Jubilee, carnival of joy. Mr. Gloom won't be about. Music always knocks him out. Sing a song, you can shout and join the Jubilee.
And the first jazz recording of When the Saints Go Marching In.
Oh, when the saints,
when the saints
go marching in.
Marching in.
Now when the saints go marching in.
Marching in.
Yes, I want to be in that number when the saints go marching in.
Louis, Brother Holmes. Louis Armstrong, the singer, possessed a magic voice that was immediately recognizable. Author Lawrence Berggren.
If you heard him sing, you would never say, oh, was that Louis Armstrong or somebody else? Nobody ever said that because he was so distinctive. When he was younger, he often had a light, lilting tenor.
Let him put you down if he dares. I'll pick you up for myself.
And he had quite a vocal range that helped him impart to his singing a sense of an urgency and lightness that really wasn't there in later years. And he kind of shifted musical gears, if you will, as his voice lowered.
You turn the tables on me. And now I'm falling for you.
People have asked me, you know, how did Louis get that low, growling, froggy voice? I think that it was part of his family or genetic inheritance. He attributed it to getting sick on the riverboats performing with Fate Marable, and that was why his voice was so low. But, you know, his sister probably didn't get sick the same way, and her voice was also very low.
By 1938, Louis was back at the top of his game, but that would not make him immune to hard personal times. He was rocked by the death of his mentor, King Oliver. After all, it was Oliver who helped him hone his craft, sharpen his playing, and it was Oliver who brought him north to Chicago. Soon after the death of King Oliver, Lewis secured a divorce from Lil after 14 years of marriage. 1 month after the divorce, he went down the aisle with his longtime companion, Alpha Smith, to begin what would be a very rocky marriage. In spite of his success, the storm clouds of World War II, divorce, the decline of the big bands, and the rise of bebop were challenges just ahead. Lewis would have to contend with them all. I'm Stanley Crouch. You're listening to Satchmo, The Wonderful World of Lewis Armstrong, a special edition of Jazz Profiles. By the early 1940s, Louis Armstrong's magnetism was well documented. He had an effect on almost everyone, but who were the influential people who touched him? It could be said that the three most influential people in Louis Armstrong's entire life were Joe Oliver, Joe Glazer, and his fourth wife, Lucille Wilson.
I didn't get into Louis' music. No one could do that. He couldn't cook in my pots and I'll not blow his horn. We each had our own position.
Veteran Armstrong producer George Avakian reflects on the romantic side of Lewis.
I remember so well the night that he introduced me to Lucille, who became his wife. We picked her up at the Lafayette Theater where she was dancing. Louis got a quart of vanilla ice cream and he said, we'll go up to her mother's house and have an ice cream party. Well, almost all the ice cream was eaten by Pops. He adored vanilla ice cream. At the end, when we took our leave, I went across the sidewalk to unlock the car door, and I turned around and Louis was still standing on the steps of this building. He had his arms stretched out to the sky, and he did a pirouette, and he said, oh, my darling, isn't she wonderful?
I saved pretty mama day by day. Don't give none away.
Dan Morgenstern is the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
That's the one that lasted. And Lucille had been a dancer at the Cotton Club, actually, when the Cotton Club had moved downtown already. That's how Louis met her. He spotted her in the chorus and immediately took a great liking to her and actually courted her. She was a little overwhelmed by that. Louis, of course, had his own ways, you know. He was very direct. This was a relatively brief courtship, and they got married, and then it lasted until Louis' death. She was somebody who understood that for him, the music came first.
Lucille Armstrong.
The trumpet comes first, and that's why we've been so happy. So none of my wives ever dug the horn. After all, without the horn, we would have no life. I learned how to wash that horn, break it down to the fine points, and clean it, and oil it, and wax it for him, and can't blow a note.
Lewis and Lucille were married in October of 1942. The marriage fortified Lewis to deal with difficult new problems. The advent of World War II and the recording ban declared by the American Federation of Musicians had changed what was business as usual. Lewis couldn't make records, nightclubs were subjected to an entertainment tax, and travel became difficult. Yes, America was at war, and Lewis contributed to the effort in his own way. He performed for troops, over the Armed Forces Radio Service, and he recorded V-discs, which were distributed to military bases worldwide. His new wife, Lucille, did not like the road.
My honeymoon was 8 months of one-nighters. You know, I hadn't traveled like that before. I was really weary and tired. And of course, our accommodations were terrible. And I hadn't been used to that. And I got to thinking, my God, do I have to live like this the rest of my life? I can't stand it. Then I almost decided, well, this marriage is not for me. Well, we came home, and so I rested, and I learned to cope with it.
Where the Suwannee River flows, the shady pine trees grow. I needn't say no more, 'cause that's my home.
She couldn't see a future for Lewis without a permanent residence for the two of them. So, in March of 1943, she returned to New York and purchased a home at 34-56 107th Street, Queens, New York.
Lucille and I, ever since we married, we've been right there in that block. And everybody keeps their little homes up like we do. And it's just like one big family. I saw three generations come up in that block.
For Lewis, the home in Queens and life with Lucille gave him the stability he never had. Dan Morgenstern is the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
She knew that he had been on the road practically all his life, and especially since returning from Europe in 35, so that was by then 7 years. He had never had a real home, not since he and Lil split up. They had a nice house in Chicago.
One of the musical highlights of Louis Armstrong's career occurred in 1946, when Louis teamed up with singer Billie Holiday in the film New Orleans. Although the film was not a hit, Billie was thrilled to get a chance to work with Louis Armstrong.
Don't lose your head, then lose your guy. You can't lose a broken heart. If you ever break up, then try to make up. It's tough to make a brand new start. Take a walk, think it over, while strolling neath the moon. Don't say things in December, you'll regret in June.
I think I copied my style from Louis Armstrong. When I was quite young, I heard a record Louis Armstrong made called The West End Blues. And I thought, this is wonderful. I like the feeling he got from it. So I wanted Louis Armstrong's feeling, and I wanted the big volume that Bessie Smith got, but I found that it didn't work with me because I didn't have a big voice, you know? So anyway, between the two of them, I got Billie Holiday.
So don't lose your head, then lose your guy, 'cause you can't lose a broken heart.
Look out, don't lose your head, then lose your gal. You can't lose a broken heart. If you ever break up, then try to make up. It's tough to make a brand new start. Take a walk and think it over while strolling beneath the moon. Don't say things in December.
In post-war America, popular tastes were changing and the big bands were in decline. This affected Louis Armstrong and his big band. Louis was in a musical rut. Author Gary Giddens.
Armstrong's reputation was in disrepair by the middle 1940s. He had been leading the band, not so much leading the band as fronting the band. He was not the music director. He certainly wasn't the arranger. But all the arrangements were there to feature him. This was a star vehicle for him. By the mid-40s, they weren't taking care of business. The arrangements were getting tired. It was hard to get good musicians. It was about just sitting there playing charts for the star. A lot of people would just stop listening.
A revolution in jazz was happening. It was fueled by new players and new listeners. It was called bebop. It was complex. It was played by small groups almost exclusively. Solos were the main focus. Lewis said, bebop and 52nd Street, that's what messed up jazz. Author Scott DeVoe agrees that bebop's new approach to the audience presented a challenge to musicians like Lewis, who were seen primarily as entertainers by the younger generation.
The disconnect from popular culture is almost a badge of pride, and Armstrong, I think, had difficulty inhabiting that world and was, in a sense, hurt by musicians who didn't seem to get it from his perspective. He talks about musicians who play a few notes and then say, pay me the money, Pops.
In the spring of 1947, the seeds of what would be rock and roll were now in the ground. Armstrong biographer, Gary Gibbs.
Louis Jordan completely stole the imagination of the country, especially the black audience. And this was very painful for Lewis because just as Frank Sinatra was the first guy who ever gave Bing Crosby anything remotely resembling rivalry in that arena, Louis Jordan was the first guy who came along and got the black community. And I believe it was in Texas, someplace he was working, to a half-empty audience while Louis Jordan's joint down the block was completely jammed. This was very painful for him, and nobody knew quite what to do with it.
Back in New York, in conjunction with the release of the film New Orleans, critic and promoter Leonard Feather arranged for Louis Armstrong's first solo appearance ever at Carnegie Hall in New York City.
I approached Joe Glazer with a suggestion. It was about time for Louis to play a concert at Carnegie Hall, which he'd never done. It seemed incredible.
Louis wanted to present his entire orchestra, but Feather just wanted to use a small group. Louis finally agreed to a split concert format.
So we set the Carnegie Hall concert for February the 8th, 1947. By the end of the program, it was quite obvious to anybody that the setting that really belonged naturally to Louis was the one where he was with a small band. And a very few months after that concert, the big band finally was disbanded, and the first great Louis Armstrong All-Stars combo was born.
Take it down to New Orleans now, folks. Living way back of town. Oh, she treated me right. Never let me down. But I wasn't satisfied. I had to run.
It didn't take long for the Louis Armstrong All-Stars to revitalize interest in traditional New Orleans music. But the All-Stars were in a class of their own. Author Gary Gibbs.
If you notice, all the traditional New Orleans bands that came along largely on the popularity of the All-Stars, like the Dukes of Dixieland and dozens of other groups like Al Hurt, Pete Fountain, all of these people had careers that were generated by the renewed popularity of Armstrong. But they're all very conventional Dixieland groups. They might play pop tunes, but you know exactly which cubbyhole to put every performance, every band, every recording. Armstrong's band is this free-floating musical universe all by itself.
In 1949, the All-Stars really got a boost when Armstrong came home and was named King of the Zulus at Mardi Gras in New Orleans. jazz critic Leonard Feather.
When I first met Louis, he spoke to me about his ambition to be the king of the Zulus during the Mardi Gras celebrations back in his hometown. And finally, in March of 1949, Louis' lifelong ambition was realized. The Zulu Club, which was a black social club, named him the king of the parade, and he invited me down there. And as I look back, all I can say is that was one of the happiest moments in Louis Armstrong's life, so more power to him.
Armstrong's return to New Orleans as King of the Zulus made headline news. Time magazine featured his picture on the cover. It was a first for a jazz musician, and it was an important moment in the life of an authentic American hero. I'm Stanley Crouch with the conclusion of Satchmo, Louis Armstrong, the Man and His Music, on this special edition of NPR's Jazz Profiles.
I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill, on Blueberry Hill. When I found you.
While working with the All-Stars, Louis still found time to record a parade of hits in a wide variety of circumstances. On September 16, 1949, Louis worked with the arranger conductor Gordon Jenkins on Blueberry Hill.
He made Blueberry Hill, which was his biggest record up to that point, but it was the biggest thrill of my life.
Now, here's a tune that knocks me out that I made in the picture with the little movie star Mickey Rooney. The title is Kiss the Bella Dreamer. Dig it.
It was summertime, 1951.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part, a kiss to build a dream on.
In the summer of 1954, Louis got together with producer George Avakian of Columbia Records.
The opportunity to record Armstrong came along.
George Avakian conceptualized an Armstrong tribute to the father of the blues, William Christopher W.C. Handy.
He was under a kind of perpetual contract to Decca Records, which was very good for building up his career, especially since the company kept trying to make him a pop seller, which was not a bad idea, and it worked very well in a few cases. What I wanted to do was get Louis to record certain ideas which fit his own early life and the development of jazz, of course. When an opportunity came along between contracts, I signed him specifically to start recording material like the music of W.C. Handy. Pops really loved that idea.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And thanks to Mr. George Avakian for hipping us to this tune, Old Mac the Knife.
When George Avakian heard Mac the Knife for the first time, he was excited.
As I listened, I thought to myself, gosh, this is an amazing piece of music. It's 8 bars long with key changes and subtle background melodies. What an opportunity for instrumental improvisation. Everybody turned it down. And finally, I started offering it to people who were not on the label. Jerry Mulligan, the Modern Jazz Quartet. The answer was universal. It's only 8 bars long, George. What can you do with it? And I said, well, that's the whole point. You can do everything with it. But nobody wanted to do anything.
Nobody, of course, except Louis Armstrong, who was the master of making silk purses from sow's ears. Louis had known for a long time that he could bring something good to almost any kind of material, and he seized the opportunity to record Mac the Knife.
Old Shark has pretty teeth, dear. and he shows them pearly white. Jack's a jackknife, as McHeat did, and he keeps it out of sight.
And it was an immediate hit. Louis Armstrong's friend and confidant, Jack Bradley.
Louis always felt the same about approaching records. He'd do anything that his manager, Joe Glazer, said. And to him, I don't think he saw any difference between country and western band and Leonard Bernstein and the New York Symphony. And it was all just music. He knew he'd make the most of it.
In 1956, producer Norman Granz created Verve Records and hired Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong to record with an all-star rhythm section that included Oscar Peterson on piano, Herb Ellis on guitar, Ray Brown on bass, and Buddy Rich on drums.
I should have seen the signal to stop. What a flop. This is how the story ends. I let him turn me down and say, can't we be, 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 can't we be friends?
Oh, yes.
Every time they tell me I'm going to make a record with Ella, man, I'm the first one in the studio, and it knocks Ella out, too.
By now, Louis was the consummate performer. He knew what so many wouldn't acknowledge. Jazz, as embodied by himself, was America's best public relations weapon. And now, Louis became Ambassador Satch. He traveled the world, creating one carnival of joy after another.
Signori e signore, abbiamo il piacere di presentarvi il grande Louis Armstrong.
Trombonist, Trombignon.
We go in Europe and he has Princess Margaret and all of them back there. Asking him about things, and he's sitting up there having court with these big people. He told us one day, how come you guys going to Israel? I told him, ask Louis. They cornered Louis, got him in some newspaper guys there one night in the dressing room and said, how come you going playing for them Jews down in Israel? Louis looked at him, he said, let me tell you something. When I go down there, the first thing they're going to tell me, how come you play for them Arabs over there? Man, he told him, he said, let me tell you something, man. That horn, you see that horn? That horn ain't prejudice. He said, a note's a note in any language.
For Louis, it was a great, big, wonderful world. His hit parade continued, and in 1964, Hello Dolly knocked the Beatles off the top of the charts and became the number one hit.
Hello Dolly, this is Louis Dolly. It's so nice to have you back where you belong.
Arvel Shaw was with Louis in Chicago, and the entire band was summoned to New York.
We flew into New York, got to the studio. They handed us the music, we ran it down, and there was Little Mill saying, you mean to tell me you called me in to play this?
After the session, the band went back on the road.
Somebody in the crowd would say, Hello, Dolly. And each night it kept getting louder. Hello, Dolly. Hello, Dolly. So Louis turned to me and said, what the hell is he talking about, Hello, Dolly? We had to send, get the sheet music, and the night we put it in the concert, pandemonium broke out. We'd been so far out there, he didn't know he had a hit.
Louis Armstrong would take tunes nobody else wanted, like Hello Dolly, Mac the Knife, and others, and turn them into his very own hits. His open attitude toward making music is a powerful lesson from a master teacher that will last for generations to come. Trombonist, Trummy Young.
Anybody could have learned from Louis. I had a long discussion with John Hendricks one time. He said, you know, I kind of envy you. You sitting there working under the greatest teacher that you can find. I say, I know it. You could learn an awful lot from Louis if you were observing, if you were aware. Anybody could, not just me. Some of it would rub off on you, you know. He was a master.
Louis the teacher was colorblind. His wonderful world was a world of love, a vision of racial equality.
We're all human and we got the same thing. You white, I'm colored, you know. So what's the difference? We all love music, we love the nice things in life.
Nothing seemed to be able to slow Louis Armstrong down, not even his failing heart.
Now the pale moon shining on the fields below, the folks are crooning soft and low. You need tell me, boy, because I know.
When it's slavery time down south.
Lucille Armstrong.
The night Louis passed, he was doing so well. It was a shock to me. It was just after his birthday, on the 5th of July, 1971. He was in great, great, great shape, with great humor. And he was telling me, he said, you know, I feel good. I got to get back to work. He didn't want his public to forget him. I said, Pops, if you never worked again in your life, your public would never forget you. He said, book me as soon as you can, because I feel good.
On July 6, 1971, Louis Armstrong died of heart failure in New York. His eulogy, 3 days later, was delivered by disc jockey Fred Robbins, who sums up the inspiration of Louis Armstrong.
Louis Armstrong captured the essence of human relations in what he did. The feeling, the mood, the spirit, and the hope of mankind. So move over, Gabriel, because here comes Satchmo, and the saints are marching in. And so Pops takes his place as the king at the head of that big jam session in the sky, in that special niche in heaven that God keeps to hold our idols, with Billy and Fats and Johnny Hodges and Bird, with Tommy and Jimmy. And Bessie.
Even today, wherever his voice is, wherever his presence is felt, his wonderful world is realized. Gary Giddens.
If you follow the prophet, you have to follow the prophet completely to wherever the prophet takes you. You can't pick and choose. Follow him on the whole trip, see where he takes you, where he goes. And if you do that, you realize that there is not a big gap between West End blues and Maine, that they all are part of the same artist and personality.
What a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white. The bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by.
Louis Daniel Armstrong transcended a lifetime of obstacles. Through tenacity and the golden power of his spirit, he used everything at his command to create a wonderful world, both for himself and for us. In the process, he became a true American hero. He shaped the destiny of the jazz world forever, and he left behind powerful lessons for all of us to learn. By going from rags to riches, Louis Armstrong realized the American dream, and he became, arguably, the most important artist in American culture. I'm Stanley Crouch.
Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Ooh, yeah.
The executive producer for Jazz Profiles is Tim Owens, assistant producer Madeline Smith. Louis Armstrong, The Man and His Music, was written and produced by Dan Morgenstern, Jim Luce, and Dick Golden. Technical director, Duke Marcos. We'd also like to thank the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University in Newark, the Hogan Archives at Tulane University in New Orleans, Gary Giddens, Phoebe Jacobs, Bruce Rayburn, Jack Bradley, the BBC, and WBTO Newark. The executive producer of The Wonderful World of Louis Armstrong is Jim Luce. We also received help from Joyce McDonald, Jennifer Kinlock, Cheryl Robinson, Jenny Lawhorn, Laura Gross, Celeste James, and Jacques Coughlin. To email us or for more information about this program and others in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for this special edition of Jazz Profiles comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, arts, and culture. Additional support has been provided by Auris, Swiss watches since 1904, on the web at auris.ch, and by Carry Audio Design, makers of high-end audio equipment for the home, on the web at carryaudio.com. The Wonderful World of Louis Armstrong is produced by the Luce Group and National Public Radio in association with WRTI-FM Philadelphia as part of the Louis Armstrong Centennial Radio Project. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thanks for listening. To hear more programs in this series, go to npr.org/jazzprofiles.